pomegranate juice is the latest craze sweeping the nation. Not only does this delicious drink leave you wanting more, it also contains more antioxidants levels than most other fruit juices. It also has a ton of vitamin C and has been linked to aid in cancer prevention, as well as helping stall the progression of Alzheimer's disease. You might be thinking, pomegranate juice is way too expensive. But fear not. Although the biggest pomegranate juice brand, Pom, is quite pricey, the store brand alternatives will do a fine job in keeping you healthy as well. This has been a message from your pomegranate juice loving DJs at WRUV 90.1 FM Burlington.
Hey, listening to WRUV FM Burlington. Just touch me. Listening to James Stewart. James Harvey Stewart, if you will. So this show's going to be a little bit different than the show we had on just a minute ago. The show's going to be basically sociology, social capital. Why should you hang out with a bunch of cool people? Like everyone outside who's hanging out. Something big's happened here at WRUV. So I'm going to play a little bit of music just to get the stuff switched over. I actually have equipment now that I can actually mix music in. So, but the first thing we're going to be covering First thing we're going to be covering is something from the Happiness Lab with Dr. Lori Santos. Make a little excerpt from Make America Happy Again. So keep on listening to WRUV FM Burlington. This is Radio Lyceum. I have an email for the show, radiolyceum@protonmail.com. So if you have any suggestions or you want... one of the goals of is to bring on nonprofit organizations to have volunteers to come on and kind of promote what they do. So, if you have any nonprofit organizations you would like to come on the show, you can send email to Radio Lyceum, all one word, at protonmail.com. Thank you.
measuring if people are satisfied, both in their lives and with their lives, and to find out what factors influence their answers.
And of course, the results are incredibly important and so different from what many politicians think matter to people.
No one, it turns out, talks about things like GDP. People are much more likely to mention loneliness, a topic that few economists or politicians have focused on, but that we now know has a huge effect on our health. It's estimated to be the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That damage could be reduced if governments invested in the right problem.
There's money that needs to be spent, but it's not a huge amount of money.
Lord Layard argues for things like tax incentives to encourage the growth of third places. He thinks governments should prioritize building plazas and parks where people can connect.
Town planning is very, very important in determining whether a space is where people naturally come together and talk to each other and can walk around and sit and chat and so on, or whether it's a kind of motorized social desert. These are real decisions that town planners can make.
You may well look around your town and see little evidence that urban planners have given much thought to bringing folks together. But just as Robert Putnam saw an upswing in community spirit after the Gilded Age, Lord Layard senses a growing interest in happiness economics in many nations.
And we're now in a really interesting situation in Britain where well-being is coming up to the floor because the party, which will probably be elected in the next election, is committed to making well-being an equal goal with GDP for its government.
And note that Lord Layard isn't advocating spending public money frivolously. All those usual hard-headed financial savings goals are built into happiness economics, too.
Our criterion for public policy is that we should be spending money on policies which create the most well-being per dollar spent. Now, by dollar spent, it means not only the dollar spent at the beginning of the process, but minus the dollars saved as a result of spending the initial dollar. Cost effectiveness, this is a sort of well-being mantra when it comes to public policy.
That's right. Public investment in improving well-being can actually save governments money. Take loneliness again. A dollar spent giving a lonely person access to a third place could save the money that would need to be spent if that person gets sick as a result of their social isolation. And as we heard in our last episode, investing in clubs and third places like sports teams, community pools, choirs, and residence associations can reduce crimes and help towns run more efficiently.
We need to make this case for investing in things which are really critical for people's well-being and will actually, many of them, save the state a lot of money.
If you're looking for a true hero of the We Society, you need to look further back in time than the 1950s and way before the Gilded Age of the 1880s. In fact, you need to go all the way back to the days of the American Revolution. Because just as America was being founded, with a declaration to give citizens the right to pursue happiness, a British philosopher was thinking deeply about what the pursuit of happiness actually meant. And Jeremy Bentham came down firmly on the moral case for collective well-being. The greatest happiness, he wrote, of the greatest number, that is the measure of right and wrong.
I thought that was absolutely mind-blowing.
As a young student, economist Lord Richard Layard loved Jeremy Bentham's work.
The way we would judge our society is by the happiness of the people. The way we would want the government to behave is to maximize well-being of the people. What are we here to do? To produce the most happiness that we can in the world.
Now, you might not be used to hearing a veteran economist like Lord Layard talking about concepts like happiness and maximizing well-being. When economists use words like maximizing, they're usually focused on money and shareholder value and country wealth as measured by GDP. It's not that economists are blind to the need to make people happier. They just love numbers and data. And until recently, psychologists like me couldn't give them any of those numbers or data because we hadn't yet come up with good ways to measure people's happiness.
And what could you say? Well, more or less all you could say is how much they could buy. And so how much they could buy became the criterion which many people thought was equivalent to well-being. And that has really been very unfortunate.
Unfortunate because it's just not true. As I say over and over on this podcast, lots of research shows that how much money people have is not a proxy for how happy they are. You can be a blissfully happy billionaire or a downright miserable one. But as the saying goes, if you're armed with a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. And until recently, economists were only armed with GDP. So they began to assume that increasing our wealth was the best path to happiness. The problem is that policymakers and leaders tend to listen to economists. So we wound up with government policies that confuse money and well-being.
This is a terrible culture.
Take Lord Layard's home country of England. He's watched politicians use economic arguments to remove funding from the places where ordinary people meet and form social capital.
Children's centres, which have been largely abolished by the present government, were very successful in bringing together mothers with young children. Youth centres, very important, and there's plenty of evidence that when they get closed down, as they have been, that's not good for crime. And then old people centres or mixed-age centres, where people regularly get together in a natural kind of way.
Governments usually want to reduce debt and promote economic growth. So they conclude that however nice it might be to let parents and teens and elders meet up and become friends, it's a luxury the country can't afford. But Lord Layard is a pioneer of a different field, known as happiness economics. And that field sees the benefits of these investments very, very differently. Lord Layard argues that concentrating solely on economic growth fails Jeremy Bentham's test of right and wrong. It doesn't bring the greatest happiness to the greatest number.
The things which were being measured are the things external. And you can see somebody's income, you can't see how they're feeling. And we have to move to a culture where we take the life as experienced and the inner life more seriously.
Fortunately for Lord Layard and other proponents of happiness economics, psychologists have now worked out how to establish if people are happy. We simply ask them.
If you graph many measures of not only social capital, but economic equality and political comity, getting along and so on, they all go down since the 1960s.
Robert was born back in 1941, and he feels very lucky to have grown up in what he considers a golden age of social capital, a period of so much we time. Every day, Robert's dad ate breakfast at the same local spot with the same fellow diners. Robert spent his formative teen years on a Port Clinton bowling team, whose members came from many diverse communities and neighborhoods.
I'm constantly at risk of seeing that town walls and risk of seeing our youth through golden haze. So I spent a lot of time actually trying to be sure I had the facts right.
And the facts are pretty shocking. Many of our third places, those spots other than home or work where we can mix and form friendships, are in terminal decline. By neglecting our clubs and associations and neighborhood hangouts over the last 60 years, it seems that we've really beaten social capital down almost to the point of extinction. But it turns out this pessimistic view isn't the whole picture. Robert realized he didn't really know what was happening to social capital before his childhood in the 1950s. So he decided to look at the earlier records. What was social capital like in World War II, during the Great Depression, or even before World War I?
And if you do that, you can see it's all one big inverted U curve.
One side of that curve tells us what we already know, that social capital now is low. But the opposite side of the graph revealed something somewhat surprising. America had experienced a similar slump in social capital in the late 1800s.
America was in a pickle back in the 1880s. We were very unequal. We were very divided politically. We were very polarized. We were very disconnected from one another.
Robert wanted to quantify just how much America in the 1800s was an I society rather than a we society. So he turned to an online database that had digitized a bunch of written material from different time periods.
It's got cookbooks and detective stories and children's books and everything you'd see if you went into a bookstore. And therefore, it's a good measure of what ordinary people are reading and writing about.
Searching this archive can tell you when different ideas were fashionable or when particular historical figures were in vogue. But Robert wanted to measure something more subtle. He needed a specific search term to test what ordinary people were reading and writing about their sense of community.
What if we compared the ratio of the first person plural to the first person singular?
Robert decided to compare our use of the word I to the use of the word we. And back in the 1880s, the first person singular won out by a landslide.
We were very much in an I mood. We were very much focused on what was good for us individually, rather than what was good for all of us together.
That era after the Civil War and Reconstruction became known as the Gilded Age. It was a time of rapid and often disconcerting technological change, a period of bitter arguments about immigration, democracy, and social justice.
The prevailing public philosophy at that time was something called social Darwinism. Natural selection, better if we don't help poor people because that'll just speed up the process of development of the human race.
This ethos allowed a small group of elite men, the so-called robber barons, to imagine.
Sorry, we just had a phone call. But I just wanted to, butt in a little bit. There's also like the name after my show, the Lyceum Movement, or Radio Lyceum's name of my show. And I wanted to, there's been other like upswings. The name of the Robert Putnam book is definitely worth checking out on one of his latest books, talking about social capital. But the Lyceum Movement is another example of where when our country was extremely young, 1840s, people were really concerned about our democracy and was it going to survive. A lot of people were like, well, democracy is just going to be a bunch of stupid people, don't know what they're doing. You need to be ruled by people that actually know what they're doing. So in response to the Lyceum Movement, which was a public lecture where people would come and socialize and debate and listen to luminaries about the subjects of the day, which included the abolition movement, women's suffrage. All these earlier movements in the 1840s were just seeded in the 1840s from the Lyceum Movement. They brought it out into the community so they could at least debate these topics among the people. And there's been other, I have another script that basically talks about the Enlightenment and earlier witch hunts and how the Enlightenment kind of brought back another place where you'd have common people come together and discuss topics of the day to bring a better world. So this is not something new. There's been other movements where society is really kind of broken down and it's come back by public discussion or even socialization. So I was a big fan of Robert Putnam's upswing, and I just wanted to see if there's other parallels to other places in history, and some historians have made those connections. So I just wanted to cut in and talk about that as well. So let's get back to this little snippet.
Amassed vast wealth while workers enjoyed little security from the fruits of their labor. And the philosophy back then was that if workers didn't like that, well, they should start their own business empire. From the top to the bottom of Gilded Age society, the I was celebrated over the we.
Red in tooth and claw, bad to help poor people, good to
be as selfish as possible. And
yeah.
I'm guessing that some of this may sound depressingly familiar. I mean, arguments about social justice and inequality, a 1% of people thriving while much of the other 99% is still struggling.
America in 1890 looked a lot like America right now. Extremely polarized, extremely unequal, extremely self-centered.